Ever feel like you're studying state law and federal law, and they're like different universes,
Totally.
like different planets?
Yeah.
So today we're diving deep into Martin v. Hunter's lessee,
Oh, yeah.
which is from 1816, and this case is basically the rule book for how those two universes interact, especially when federal law comes into play.
Yeah, it's really the who's the boss moment for American law.
Right, exactly. So to kind of set the stage, historically, this is post-Revolutionary War America, right? And there are a lot of questions still swirling around about, the balance of power between the states and the new federal government.
Definitely. A lot of tension, you
Yeah.
know? You had this real push and pull between ideas of state sovereignty and also the need for a unified national legal framework. Like, how do we make this all work together? And this case really emerged right in the middle of that whole debate.
And so at its heart, it was a property dispute in Virginia.
Right. Land always comes back to land, doesn't it?
It always does somehow.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
yeah, it was over land that had been confiscated from a loyalist during the Revolution. So we've got Martin, who's the loyalist's heir, trying to get the property back. And we've got Hunter, who received a land grant from the state.
Yeah, and on the surface, it seems pretty straightforward, you know, who owns this piece of land.
Right.
But the bigger question that comes out of this is, does the U.S. Supreme Court even have the authority to tell a state court what to do when federal law is involved?
Right, and that's what makes this so interesting. It's not just about the land anymore. It's about the structure of our whole legal system.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's get into the specifics a little bit here. The land we're talking about is the Northern Neck Proprietary in Virginia. It was originally owned by Lord Fairfax, who was a loyalist.
Right.
And after the Revolutionary War, Virginia decided to confiscate his land, like a lot of states did with loyalists' property.
They took the land and granted it to David Hunter.
Okay, but here's where it gets tricky, because we have the Treaty of Paris from 1783, which ended the war, and then later Jay's Treaty. Both of those treaties aim to protect the property rights of the loyalists.
Yeah, so you have a direct clash here. Virginia state law saying this land is ours, and federal treaty saying, hold on, the original owner's rights should be protected.
So then Thomas Martin, who is Lord Fairfax's heir, he sues Hunter to get the land back, arguing that the treaty should win out. And the Virginia State Court actually initially agrees with him. They recognize the validity of the treaties. You would think that would be the end of it, right? Federal law wins, case closed,
You would think.
but not so fast.
Nope.
The Virginia Court of Appeals reverses the lower court's decision. They rule for Hunter, basically saying, Virginia can confiscate this land. We don't care what the treaties say.
It's really fascinating how these two courts in the same system can interpret the same federal treaties in completely opposite ways. Makes you think about the messiness of the law.
It does. And so this is where it goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court for the first time in 1813.
Right. Yeah.
And the Supreme Court looks at the treaties and sides with Martin.
Yeah.
So basically upholding the treaty provisions and saying, Virginia, you can't confiscate this land.
They really asserted federal law there.
They did. But then it gets even crazier because the Virginia Court of Appeals refused to comply with the Supreme Court's ruling.
I know. Can you believe that? A direct challenge.
I know. They basically said, we're not bound by this decision. And then they went so far as to declare Section 25 of the Judiciary Act of 1789 unconstitutional.
Yeah, that's the law that gave the Supreme Court the power to review state court decisions involving federal law. So it was a huge escalation of the conflict.
Right. So round two at the Supreme Court, and
Yeah.
now the stakes are so much higher. It's not about who owns this piece of land anymore.
Oh no, it's a power struggle.
It's about who has the final say in interpreting federal law.
Exactly. So the court has these two big questions in front of them. First, does the Supreme Court have the authority to review and potentially overturn state court decisions on federal law? And second, is the very law that gives them this power, Section 25 of the Judiciary Act, is it even constitutional?
So those are some pretty weighty questions.
Huge. And this is where Justice Story writes a really important majority opinion.
So what were the main points of his argument?
Well, he starts by emphasizing the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, Article 6,
Right.
basically saying that federal law is the supreme law of the land. And if that's true, state courts can't have the final say on federal legal issues.
Right.
Because think about it, if every state court could interpret federal law differently, you would have total chaos, inconsistent rulings everywhere.
Yeah, it would be like a legal Wild West.
Exactly. That was Story's big argument for uniformity. And imagine if each state had its own interpretation of interstate
Oh
commerce.
my gosh, a nightmare.
It would be impossible to do business across state lines. and then Story tackles the constitutionality of Section 25, he argues that Article 3 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to create the Supreme Court and define its jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress giving the Supreme Court the ability to review state court decisions on federal matters was totally legitimate.
Okay.
And he has this really powerful quote about who actually created the Constitution. He writes, "The Constitution was ordained by the people of the United States, not the states themselves."
Right. So it's really coming from the people as a whole, not just the individual states.
Exactly. And that undermines the idea that states can ultimately decide what federal law means.
Okay. So was everyone on the court in agreement?
Well, Justice Johnson agreed with the outcome, but he wrote a concurrence.
Okay.
He was a little cautious about federal overreach.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was important to respect the independence of state courts.
That makes sense.
So he agreed with the idea of federal supremacy in this specific case, but wanted to maintain a balance between federal and state power.
So even though this case firmly establishes federal supremacy, it's not like the states just disappear from the equation.
Right. They still have their role to play.
Okay. So for someone studying law, what are the key takeaways from this case in terms of when the Supreme Court can review a state court decision?
Well, Martin didn't lay out a super clear-cut test like some other cases, but it did establish some important conditions. Basically, for the Supreme Court to have the power to review a state court decision, the case has to involve some aspect of federal law, whether that's a law, a treaty, or the Constitution itself.
Okay.
Second, the state court has to have ruled against a right or a claim that's based on that federal law, treaty, or the Constitution. And third, it has to be the final judgment from the state court. Like, they've exhausted all their appeals within the state system.
So if those three things are present, then the Supreme Court can step in.
Right. They can exercise their appellate jurisdiction.
So the Supreme Court has ruled, Virginia has to back down. But what were the real-world consequences of this decision, both immediately and in the long term?
Well, in the immediate aftermath, Martin v. Hunter's Lessee really solidified the principle of federal judicial supremacy.
Right.
It made it clear that the Supreme Court was the ultimate authority on federal law and that their decisions applied even to state courts.
So it wasn't just a suggestion?
No, it was the law of the land. State courts couldn't just ignore federal law or what the Supreme Court said about it.
And how did it impact the balance of power between the states and the federal government?
It struck a really delicate balance that's still relevant today.
Right.
It affirmed the supremacy of federal law when there's a conflict, but it also acknowledged that state courts still have an important role to play within their own sphere.
Right.
So it wasn't a total federal takeover, but it did establish a clear hierarchy when it comes to federal law.
And the impact of this case extends far beyond this one property dispute, right?
Absolutely. Martin laid the groundwork for so many future landmark cases where federal courts, especially the Supreme Court, could review and even overturn state laws or decisions based on the Constitution.
And this is where we get cases like Brown v. Board of Education, right?
Exactly. The Supreme Court, using its power to interpret the 14th Amendment to strike down segregation in public schools.
Wow. So without Martin v. Hunter's Lessee, desegregation might have looked very different.
Very different. It's hard to imagine how such a sweeping change at the state level could have been enforced nationwide without that precedent.
So at the end of the day, it was so much bigger than just who owned a piece of land.
Way bigger. It was about who has the ultimate authority to interpret our nation's laws. And that's a question that's still relevant today.
It definitely is. So as you're studying law, think about this. What if state courts had the final say on federal law? How different would things be?
Right. What would happen to things like interstate commerce, environmental regulations, or even constitutional rights?
Yeah, what kind of inconsistencies and challenges would we face without a single final authority on these issues?
It's something to think about.
It is.